Victor Platt is the Thomas S. and Elizabeth Taft Distinguished Professor in Environmental Law and Director of the Center for Law, Environment, Adaptation, and Resources for the University of North Carolina School of Law. He received his undergraduate degree from Vanderbilt and his law degree from Northwestern. His scholarship is primarily focused on Clean Air and Clean Water Act, and more recently on the legislative and regulatory mechanisms needed to address climate change in the U.S. John Cruden is the Deputy Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice Environmental and Natural Resources Division. He graduated from West Point and Santa Clara Law School and received a Master's in Government and Foreign Affairs from the University of Virginia. As Supervisor of the ENRD's Environmental Enforcement and Environmental Crime Section, he oversees environmental litigation, including civil enforcement actions under various environmental statutes, EPA rulemaking challenges, and environmental actions filed against the federal government. Eric Schaefer is the co-founder and director of the Environmental Integrity Project. He received his law degree from Georgetown and his undergraduate degree from Vanderbilt. He also served as director of EPA's Office of Civil Enforcement. Juana Wilcher is a partner at English Lucas Creason Owsley in Bowling Green, Kentucky. She received her law degree from Northern Kentucky University and her undergraduate degree from Western Kentucky University. She has served as the Assistant Administrator for the EPA Office of Water and Secretary of the Kentucky Environmental and Public Protection Cabinet. Now I'll turn it over to our author, and let's all welcome our panelists.
I want to thank specifically the distinguished panelists. These are amazing folk, and to have their time to go through this article is really quite remarkable, and I'm really looking forward to their comments. In fact, though, before we get started, I will say that for those of you who had a chance to read the summary article or the article itself, I know you're probably thinking, they told me there wouldn't be math in law school. That makes it a little hard, and that may be one of the reasons why we often don't get the data, I think empirical data, we would like to see to help us determine what we're doing and how we're doing it. So thank you to Vanderbilt, thank you to the ELI, to Linda, to Michael, and to Joanna, who edited the article, and to the assistance of the Law Review. Our hope, as with all environmental legal scholarship, is obviously that we actually use the law to make improvements in health and environmental well-being in a fair and efficient manner. With respect to this article, I will start out by noting that there is a time lag, as there is with many of these articles. We started gathering data in late 2006. The data that we were able to get was from 1999 to 2003. That was later limited to 2000 to 2003 because of state data. There have been some, and I would say some positive changes in how data is gathered and utilized since that time. I think we could go further, and I'll talk about that at the end, but I at least want to acknowledge that this has been a focus of the EPA, it's a focus of other agencies, and I'm pleased that there at least is a push to try and gather data in a way that can be more useful to telling us information. So this brings me to the genesis of this piece. This is one in a line of articles and studies that have attempted to find out if our environmental laws are effectively enforced. Do they do the job they're supposed to do? And if they do they do it in an effective, an efficient, and a fair manner, right? Have we really brought down pollution? Have we really protected public health? And have we done so in as an economically efficient way as possible? Wrapped up in this question is the policy debate about which kinds of enforcement are the most effective. And in particular, whether something known as cooperative-based enforcement, which came into vogue in the mid to late 80s and into the 90s, is more effective or as effective as deterrence-based enforcement, or if cooperative-based enforcement or some combination thereof may be effective at a lower cost, or as effective at a lower cost. Now, this policy debate has been going on, off and on, flaring at various times for over two decades. But this debate is very important because it influences decisions about funding for environmental agencies overall and for environmental enforcement, among other things. And particularly as we've just been through this budget debate at the national level, which focused on cutting funds in some ways for agencies, and as we see this same debate playing out in states, I think this is a really critical question. Can we get effective environmental enforcement, and can we do it more effectively and more cheaply, and if so, how? Now, the problem is that measuring the effectiveness of environmental enforcement, to make an understatement, has not historically been an easy task to undertake. And I know Eric has had to deal with this over a long, long period of time. There are many problems. There have been relatively few markers of environmental health that are consistent over time and space. So obviously the optimal question to ask is the environment better? Right? And is the environment better in this jurisdiction that did things in this way versus this jurisdiction that did things in this way? That would be the optimal question. But we don't have good data from over time. We also don't have the way data is gathered being consistent between jurisdictions. And probably the most important is we do not have agreement on what confounding variables may be involved in improving an environment beyond environmental enforcement. So, because of that, we've had to use proxies. And there are some proxies that have been used, such as number of enforcement actions. In other words, if we take more actions, then we're doing a better job. That, at certain times and certain places, has been used as a proxy for environmental enforcement. But the problem with a marker like this is that it both assumes that more enforcement, or more specifically, deterrence-based enforcement, is better. And it assumes that enforcement actions per se mean that the environment is better or improving. And we know from some other studies, some I've worked on in the 90s and other folks, that just because a state actually takes an enforcement action doesn't mean that the enforcement action is designed to deter or, in fact, is more designed to reach a negotiated settlement with the regulated party to avoid a citizen suit. So in order to undertake an examination of the effectiveness of enforcement, we chose a different proxy. And the proxy we chose was the length of time a source remains noncompliant. The average length of noncompliant time a source is noncompliant with its permit. Other things being equal, and that's a very important caveat which I'll come back to, the length of noncompliance time should serve as a proxy of environmental health, since noncompliance is, by definition, a violation that is assumed to be bad for the environment. Furthermore, it is more likely that whatever we call enforcement, if it's more effective, it would be faster and quicker at bringing a source into compliance. Not just bringing an action, but making sure the action is effective enough to bring the non-compliant sources back into compliance. As an outcome of the length of the non-compliance time, it would be also, we decided, good to see if we could test this deterrence versus cooperative approach, right? Do we get a better outcome if we have cooperative approaches? Do we get a better outcome if we have deterrent-based approaches? Unfortunately, as I know the commenters will presumably discuss this, we were not able to get generalized data for this. We were hoping we could use the different states as tests or laboratories because a lot of the rhetoric about cooperative-based enforcement had come out of certain states. But unfortunately, we could not find what we considered a consistent, reliable marker for whether a state favored deterrence or cooperative-based enforcement. There were two variables, too many policy pronouncements versus legislative pronouncements versus regulatory things as well. Other scholars, Rob Glicksman and his colleague Earnhardt, had looked at a subset of sources in the chemical manufacturing industry which were polled on this issue of deterrence versus cooperative-based enforcement, but we were trying to do a much more broad-based, full permitted sources across the entire spectrum where we don't have that data. So as a proxy, we decided to look at political alignment, conservative versus liberal ideology, just to see if that had any relationship at all to this. And the reason we came up with that is that, again, in the rhetoric, you see that it's generally assumed that the more conservative ideology has been associated with the push for more cooperative-based enforcement. And then obviously that's not a complete tie-in, and that's why we just thought we would see what this happened. But the most important variable that we wanted to examine was the per capita spending on environmental programs in the different jurisdictions. A key component of this, of course, is that we have to make sure that all other things are equal or held equal. That's the sine qua non of this kind of statistical analysis, that you can do a regression analysis to control for source differences so that you're not comparing a dry cleaner in Kentucky to a coal-fired power plant in Ohio, that you're only comparing a mercury violation at a major plant in Ohio with a mercury violation at a major plant in Kentucky. And we did that. So to do that, we were able to use the industrial category and violation variables as determined by the EPA in their permits. This is through the RCRA permit, Clean Water Act permit, and Clean Air Act Title V permit. And we believe this is as close and probably as good as we can to come to comparing like to like. Now, as a preliminary notion, I'll note that 10 years ago or 15 years ago, this was not possible. This was not possible because at that time, states reported these variables differently, and they used different computer programs that were not necessarily consistent or readable with the EPA's own programs. So to the extent you actually wanted to compare like sources, you would have to get every source's permit history, you would have to manually enter the 50 to 200 data points, and then run it in a computer. Now, thank goodness EPA and the states have improved that. And so starting in the late 90s, they had one system that could read these entirely and would allow you to manipulate the data and find out these more robust pieces of information. So we took 17 what we considered representative states. We talked to more statistical folks about what would be representative depending on what we wanted. We tried to get states that were more populous, that had what were considered more complex environments, and that were known for as being both conservative and liberal. And that was sort of how we gathered that. So, given all that setup, what did we find? Well, the most important thing we found is it's really hard to get the data you need to do these studies, and I'm going to come back to that at the end. But given the data we had, the one thing that we think is the most important about our findings was that there is a very strong correlation in the Clean Air Act between per capita spending on environmental programs and shorter non-compliant times. In other words, holding like for like of source violations across states, the states that spent more on their environmental programs brought their sources, these like sources, their like sources came into compliance at a statistically significant faster rate than states that spent less. We thought this was important for a couple of reasons. One, while it doesn't completely answer, obviously, the cooperative versus the deterrence-based issue, it at least begins to answer the question of whether you really do or can save significant amounts of money and still get equivalent enforcement. This doesn't obviously solve that question or say, no, you can't get better enforcement for less money. But it does tell us that in the current systems that we have, that we do need to have resources in the field in order to bring sources into compliance and do effective compliance. Now, if I'm ever talking to somebody like just a friend or another law professor and they're like, well, what did you find out? I said, well, we found out that if you spend more money, you get better compliance. And they're like, okay. but because for most people that seems like, well, duh. But really that's not duh, right? That is an important thing to empirically test because maybe we are spending too much money on enforcement in some cases, right? Maybe that's true. Or maybe there is a cheaper way to do it. Or maybe cooperative enforcement is better. And there is a long literature about this, and we wanted to engage that and try to at least come up with some kind of data point that we can. We don't know whether or not this finding, if you will, among the states is easily generalized to the EPA or not. We were asked questions about that or across regions. And I think that can be more work for the future, at least since we've got down a way to at least a proxy for enforcement or not. We also saw some hints that a combination of cooperative and deterrent-based approaches might be the best rather than one or the other, which goes along with some other anecdotal history that we've read about this. But I guess I'm going to say maybe most importantly, what we came up with is sort of the problems that we started with, which is that we really have problems with data. And as I said at the beginning, that has improved over time. And if I were to go back now and try to do this again, it would be, one, easier to get the data. Hopefully some of the data would be better corrected. And we might be able to do this kind of calculation more easily. However, there are a few things that I still think may need correction. First, and very importantly, I believe that the agencies, and again EPA may have be doing this now, need to have a system set up for quality control on data entry, on double data entry. And you can do this by spot checking and do a statistical analysis of whether the data you get is correct and correctly matches what was entered. Why that? Well, we found that all of our data on the Clean Water Act non-compliance average time was unusable because it was miscategorized in the data set in the computer place, it's variable for data for three years. None of it was useful. We also talked to EPA, we couldn't figure out what they had intended to do. It was a marker about dates, because we were comparing dates of noncompliance, and it wasn't entered in anything that remotely resembled a date, as opposed to RCRA and the Clean Air Act. So that's a real problem, right? And just that, correcting that kind of data, is something that would go a long way towards helping us. And I think that kind of double-checking on data and data entry probably has occurred more now, or does occur, but is just something I wanted to flag as being important for the future. The other thing that I think is very important is that if we are going to continue to figure out or study whether or not cooperative-based enforcement or deterrence-based enforcement or resources are particularly necessary to get good environmental enforcement, we are going to have to get better data on money and resources and how it's spent. We came up with the biggest category we could for environmental programs for the states we looked at. And this wasn't easy. All of this data had to be gathered by hand. States report their programmatic spending very differently across agencies. And so we took the largest environmental agencies that we could. We backed out data that wasn't related to pollution control, that was related to resources or agriculture or health centers, et cetera. So we did the best we could with that. But one thing we came away with was the thought that if we really want to find out more information about this, we need the states to report their data in a uniform manner about their programs. And just a very simple way, or one way to do that, is reporting expenditures by program, air, water. I know we want to move away from silos, but at least for testing the enforcement, you know, air, water, RCRA, or other programs, and then splitting that further between what we consider traditional enforcement, that is maybe prosecution, bringing notices, versus the rest of the program. Because cooperative-based enforcement often goes into the rest of the program. It's not about bringing, you know, the fines or the enforcement. It's about helping people avoid that in the first place. So it may seem awful to ask a state, repackage everything you do in your budget report for us, but we do it all the time. No Child Left Behind requires that states do that for schools now. We may or may not agree with that law, but we can do it. As a person at a public university, I'm required for my center to divide up the time in terms of objectives that the university identifies. I have to go back and say, well, I guess 1/8 of my hour that day was for this, and I guess another one was for that. And somebody has to do it. It's, you know, a little bit of additional work, but I don't think it's infeasible. I'll end this opening by noting that there are a lot of problems with this article, and I know these folks are going to identify several of them. We found out that political ideology maybe isn't a really good marker for this. We tried to get the best one we could based on other statistical analyses, but the ideology index, while being considered somewhat robust, we used it. Maybe we shouldn't even be going there. A lot of people said, don't even look at politics. Stay away from that. Don't look at liberal or conservative or Republican or Democrat. Just stay away. And maybe that's the better answer, particularly since our agencies do have to work in a nonpartisan environment. Also, as you read through the article, we start out with one goal. We end up with a result that is partly related to our original goal. We left that in there because we were trying to illustrate the difficulty of following and getting the data that we needed. In that sense, it's more muddled than perhaps we would like it to be. I'm hoping now that we've gone through this once and with more critiques that we can improve this and get a much more robust and better analysis of this in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. John? What a treat to be here in a somewhat more academic environment than my normal day or my day when I go back to the Department of Justice. But thank you for ELI. Thank you for Vanderbilt for putting this together. This is an extremely good set of panelists. They are my friends. We have agreed on so little else. We probably won't agree today, except on one major issue, which I bet we do all agree on, and that is the importance of enforcement. I used to work for somebody who, as you left his office, there was a sign there that you saw when you walked out every single time that said, every time that you set a standard that you do not enforce, you are thereby setting a lower standard, which, if you think about it, is absolutely true. I cannot resist by saying on the last couple of panels, which I thought were great, on greenhouse gas, we will file our merits brief on August the 18th, our first merit brief on about three or four cases. And you should all be following, the Supreme Court will argue April the 19th, the AEP decision, which is the common law of carbon dioxide, which is extraordinary. And Wendy, on administrative law, I just gave a speech that where I argued to those of you who are students in the audience that environmental law has taken over administrative law, that all the major cases that are studied now in administrative law are really environmental cases. And so Chevron covers the entire waterfront for everything. I want to start out by commending the article. I think these things are enormously important for all, those of us who are practitioners because we're trying to figure out where do we put our scarce resources, and it's very helpful to us when people are giving us advice. I say that before I, you know, offer some thoughtful comments, but I do start out that second, and that is this is the first time I've seen anything that's studied based on resources. It is intuitive, I think, and certainly we think that inside the federal government, that you can do more with more. And you know, in this particular climate, less with less. But I actually, this is, in fact, the first time I had seen somebody try to use that as a measurement, and I found it fascinating, that particular examination. And in fact, the, you know, the conclusion under the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, which is, you know, basically on the Clean Water Act, if you have more resources, you have more fines. Under the Clean Air Act, if you have more resources, you would have a lesser time of noncompliance. In my own world, makes sense. That seems to be about right, that those would, in fact, flow from that. All enforcement actions do not result in penalties by any means, but enough do that, in fact, that would be a very significant marker. And I would think, in fact, that with more resources, meaning that you'd have more enforcement and you can have things like inspections, which are enormously important as a deterrent effect, and then you get more quantitative, perhaps, enforcement out of that, that would, in fact, the deterrent effect from that shorten the time of noncompliance. And so the results, those limited results that were there, I think make good sense. I do not, however, believe that the words cooperative enforcement are an oxymoron. Cooperation is what occurs before we bring an enforcement action. After we bring an enforcement action, it is no longer cooperative. We have entered the adversarial situation right then, and that is exactly what we do. I think there's a very important place for cooperation and training and education and bringing people into compliance with the law. That is an important part of what state and federal agencies have to do. In a large part, they do it through education. A long time, they do it by giving lead time. When a regulation goes out, sometimes you give 6 months or even a year of an opportunity to know about that and learn about that before you actually come into compliance. And that is extraordinarily important. I just think the concept that of voluntary enforcement don't work. And in fact, in the empirical attempt that they, the authors went through, they really weren't able to find much in that area, which is not surprising to me because I don't think you could find data suggesting that cooperative enforcement works. I don't think it does work there. I would also say that the notion that you could, in fact, measure as a metric state ideology, those that you have, you know, my response, which is out front if you haven't got it already, where I criticize using state ideology as a metric. By the way, I'm at the Department of Justice, but I'm speaking in my articles in my individual capacity. I didn't think it was a good metric. I didn't think that worked, and I thought it, in some ways it confuses a bit what I think of as policy issues and enforcement issues. Policy issues are ones that are not yet very often grounded in law. There is not a statute that requires somebody to do something. You're really talking about things that maybe you want to occur in the future, and then without question, ideology can have effect on that. But my own experience, certainly in the federal government through many different administrations, is when you get to enforcement, that's rule of law issues. Now it's you're applying a set of facts to a set of, in fact, potential violations, and you're moving forward in that direction. And frankly, I haven't found ideology to be something that really controlled that in any of the administrations that I've been a part of. So I did not find that to be a good metric for judging the effectiveness of enforcement. The one other thing that I would offer, and that is, again, because this is an area that I practice, I supervise enforcement, I understand the value of looking nationally and trying to use national figures and trying to come up with deterrent numbers or quantitative numbers. I understand the value of all of that. But it's not how we, in fact, progress on a day-to-day basis. That's not what we do. We take a case where we think there is a violation of law, and we sue people for those. When we sue them, here's what we're trying to accomplish. First of all, we're trying to bring that company or individual or state or locality into compliance with the law, our very first step. Second, to the extent that there is a mess, we want them to clean it up. And that is true whether it's a Superfund site or it's our current litigation in the Gulf oil spill. We want them to make the environment whole. And then third, we want to make sure that that company or that individual doesn't do it again, which is to say there is no recidivism. In the criminal context, and this is an article really on civil enforcement, not on criminal enforcement, there's a lot written about recidivism, what it means, how you prevent it, and very often that's a metric. I think that's a fair metric here, too. I do think we would all value knowing, in the cases that were brought, state or federal government, are we meeting those standards that I just said? Are we meeting the standard that in that particular case, we brought the company to compliance with the law, we cleaned up any mess that they made, or they cleaned up any other mess that they made, and then finally, were enough things set into motion that made it either unlikely or, in fact, very prohibitive for that company or individual to do it again? I think those are all valuable metrics in some ways, and there's really more data available. So my conclusion is, good start. I thought that we got some valuable things. There's things out of it that I don't agree with, but I actually think it added to our knowledge. Keep at it. Thank you.
Great. Eric?
Thanks, and it's a pleasure being here. I both enjoyed the article and found it very painful to read because I remember struggling with the issues for years and years at EPA of how to measure performance. And in fact, I thought the article subtitle could be "There's Got to Be a Way to Do This." one of the more useful things is the sort of walk through what's missing and what's inconsistent and how frustrating it is to try to get your arms around measuring environmental performance. In the end, I spent less time critiquing the method. I found some issues I could point to, but I think the problem is the question as posed at the beginning is not answerable and is not likely to be for years, even if we work very hard to improve and better analyze the information we have. And I also think trying to link enforcement to this huge cart of environmental performance and see how fast enforcement is, I'm not sure that's quite the right test. There are a lot of things that move changes in the environment for the better. Enforcements can be a part of that, but there are other factors that are really, really important. And so, you know, you risk confusing those, and it's just very difficult to get that cause and effect relationship that you're looking for. I mean, of course, if I'm talking to a less sophisticated audience than this one about the environment in some general way, try to remember to bring the statute book and hold it up and shake it and say, this is just what Congress did, okay? We're not even talking about the rules, which there would not be enough room for the audience if we brought the rules and the preambles and all the underlying documents in here. If you want to, and I'm not being quite fair to OSHA, but if you want to contrast EPA's mission with OSHA's, in OSHA, generally, the idea is don't kill people, at least in an obvious way, at the workplace, and don't hurt them badly enough to keep them away from work, right? So that's more or less OSHA. Go to EPA, what are you looking at? You're looking at, take stuff out of the air, wait, don't put it in the groundwater, and drinking water, no contaminants there of certain kinds. Obviously we've got what you put in the water, but that can be measured by stream, by watershed, by coastal area. You've got land-based programs that, for the life of me, I'm struggling to figure parts of RCRA out, and figuring out the definition of solid waste can take you a lifetime. Trying to wrap a measurement around that is a problem. Wetlands, protect wetlands, don't fill them. What's a wetland after Swank and Rapanos? There's a great decision by a federal judge after Rapanos, a district court judge, where he said, I read the opinion, damned if I know, I'm out of here, I'm asking to be recused, I'm too old, I'm not doing that. Okay? So try to get your arms around that, and then try to add all those things up and turn that into the environment as a denominator, and I think you really will go insane. So just don't do that. That would be my first bit of advice. Try to slice the problem into manageable sections, and maybe you can work out with there. Start with media. If you want to look at sort of environmental performance as what's happening in the air and water, there are pretty good ways to measure ozone and particulates, for example. The agencies have put a ton of time into that, both at the federal and state level. The monitoring is not what people think it is. I always feel like these numbers come out and it's kind of like, ask Mr. Government, and he'll say X, and then you find out, well, there's a monitor here and there's one, 800 miles away, and we hope between them the air is kind of the same. Nevertheless, there is a network of monitors. Over time, it's pretty clear in most areas of the country, the ozone levels have drastically been reduced. If you talk to state agencies, eastern agencies in particular, they have done a lot of work to link the big drops in NOx emissions from power plants driven by ozone transport rules to changes in ozone levels. They're convinced that there's very clear cause and effect. So there are places that I don't think get enough attention or study or advertising where you can say, this worked, okay? We had a transport issue. We sort of surmised there was a relationship between pollution and loading and exposure, and here's what happened. There are places you can do that. It won't be the environment in a big way, and enforcement may only have a piece of the action, in some cases not the major share. On the water side, some ability to do that. I look at the list of impaired waters. I don't think we're nearly where we should be. My best example is two Midwestern states. On one side of the river, same river, don't eat the fish. On the other side, go ahead, have a fish fry. It's fine, no fish advisory, same river. So reading the data on toxic loadings completely differently. And that's just absurd, and actually, I think a failure of leadership at EPA, and unbelievable that the problem hasn't been solved. But there are places you can start to do some comparative analysis looking at the ambient environment. If you want to look at compliance, and you're defining that as complying with the law, but also getting emissions down, I would suggest the single biggest factor driving compliance forward is not enforcement, although I think that's important, but the where the environments are clear and straightforward and where the monitoring is accurate and timely and where the information is reported and is transparent. If you have all those things together, and that's very difficult to do, a lot of people lobby not to have that, right? But if you can bring all those things together, I would argue you get a pretty awesome compliance where you have it. Look at the acid rain program as one example, but there are other areas where the industry's been required to put in the continuous emission monitors, for example, and they generally have to track their emissions on an hourly or even a minute-by-minute basis. Generally, people with that kind of transparency, with exceptions, will not deliberately violate the law. That is a pretty stupid thing to do. And it's not that it doesn't happen, but generally people will comply. I think if you sort of want an example where we have sort of have that, but don't have the same level of compliance, the discharge monitoring reports for major sources in the Clean Water Act do require periodic monitoring and reporting. Information is reasonably transparent. That's an area where, for major sources, the data is sort of consistent nationally. In some areas, you get very good compliance. New Jersey thinks a mandatory minimum penalty that they put in place has an impact. In other cases, there doesn't seem to be. The compliance rates seem lower. Non-compliance is higher. But at least the data is consistent enough, you can do some comparison. And I think that's an area of sources where with a push, you're going to get a push from enforcement, but with the addition of the baseline monitoring, you're going to get much better performance, and you can measure the impact of programs. You know, the sort of contrast, obviously, probably most notoriously, is New Source Review, where the requirement more or less is if you expand your plant and it increases emissions, then you got to get a permit and you got to do a whole lot of controls, unless it's a routine repair or you manage to net out or it's, you know, you're exempt under one of about 15 other theories. You've got all kinds of ambiguity. Determining compliance rates in that area is going to be really, really challenging. Another one would be large confined livestock operations. We've got a Fifth Circuit decision now, which pretty much kills monitoring for these operations. Unless you catch them in a discharge, right, which you need monitoring for to do in the first place. So we're going to be spinning around in that area, and I would never trust any numbers I got about compliance from that particular sector. We've got a long, long way to go. On the brighter side, you have a D.C. Circuit decision, December of 2008, which takes a 1990 provision of the Clean Air Act and says you got to have monitoring that's sufficient to assure compliance with the limits in your Clean Air Act permit. A fairly obvious statement, but one that hasn't been really enforced or implemented. Even in the Clean Air Act, and even for the very biggest sources, the level of the gaps between what industries assume and what they report are that the numbers can vary by an order of magnitude on a particulate matter. We have a suite of large power plants in Texas. You're supposed to meet a particulate matter emission limit averaged over every 3 hours. So it's an hourly limit. Averaging time is 3 hours. How is that? How is monitoring determined? Well, there was a stack test in 1982, right? That's it. There's nothing else, right? That's not a limit at all, in my opinion. So that is more common than people realize, even at sophisticated refineries with expensive, compliance management staff and well-meaning people. You get reports about releases from flares or leaks from process units, and these are enormous and they have big health consequences. One company will report 10, the other company will report 1,000. No difference in production or quality of the crude. It's how they're calculating the numbers. This is not a problem that EPA has solved, and I honestly don't think it's fair to hold enforcement by itself accountable for it. And enforcement will never be able to do its job unless that's nailed down. And I don't think where we don't have that good monitoring, we're ever really going to know what compliance levels are, because I think most companies, like most people, will basically slide backwards where there's ambiguity and lack of accountability. It's human nature, and I don't think companies are exempt from that. With respect to enforcement, one last thing, because we talked about rulemaking in the last panel. You know, the reaction I get is often, why don't you fix the darn rules, you know, if they're so complicated? Well, because it's political, and these things are a gigantic compromise, usually, between the agency and industry and NGOs and courts. So it ain't that easy. I mean, we should work on it, but it's not because somebody fell asleep in, you know, the air traffic control tower. It's basically because that was the best the agency could do. That is often the case. With respect to a lot of the monitoring issues, however, I don't think they get enough attention. I think the industry has typically lobbied for a lot less monitoring and done that in a very sophisticated way. I think that hurts them because it means when you want flexible permits, for example, people fuss and oppose them because you're basically making up, you're making up data. On the flip side, from an NGO perspective, I would sometimes, anyway, prefer a somewhat higher limit with much better monitoring, because you know what you're getting. And without that, you risk it being really 10 times worse, which is what we run into and see all the time. So enforcement. The thing to remember about enforcement, certainly EPA enforcement, is that part of government is typically left kind of taking out the trash. By that, I do not mean to refer to the class of defendants who are all honorable people, ably represented, and so on. I'm talking about the holes in the statute, the exemptions, the ambiguities, the areas of confusion, where it appears the industry's taken advantage of it, the defendants taken advantage of it, and the government has to do something. But it is not a situation, typically, for the Justice Department, where the speed limit's 100 and, the meter says 150. That does happen. But the new source review cases in particular, they're not about that. They're about people gaming the system in an area where the regulations are set up to make gaming rise to, it becomes like the state of the art for the practice. That's where enforcement is. So when you're trying to take that effort and attach it to compliance rates in an area where you can't really measure compliance very well and extrapolate from that to environmental performance, wow. That is a heavy, heavy lift. I mean, I like a kind of simpler approach when you look at rating enforcement, which is, let's be fair to the program. There's always going to be stuff that isn't done at EPA. There are going to be holes and gaps and so on when enforcement acts. Are they getting people back into compliance relatively quickly? And are they punishing misconduct, okay? Those are in tension. You can't often solve both those problems at the same time. And what enforcement's always thinking about is, do I want this fast, or do I want to get a big penalty because the conduct is egregious and I want to put a marker down? Very occasionally, you can bring those two values together, but not very often. So I would plead for anybody looking at enforcement performance to keep that tension in mind and understand you ought to have both of those things measured, and then we can debate their relative value in the in the context of specific situations.
Okay, but I'm not going to wait for it to turn on. We'll catch up in a minute. Okay. First, let me say that it's a real honor and privilege to be here and join the distinguished panelists and authors and scholars. I agree with some of the things they all said and disagree with some of the things they all said. Let me just start. It just strikes me so. John Cruden's remarks that, we all want enforcement. We all do want reasonable, fair, appropriate enforcement. And I did you detect a little bit that once something is filed, that he has this perspective that we're not going to be friends anymore. kind of, you know, once it's a very adversarial position. I will say that when I was at EPA and we had enforcement in the program offices then, at least to start them, we had a gun code enforcement official who was very effective, Jim Elder, wastewater enforcement guy. And I would say, Jim, it's get all the money that's appropriate, send them to jail as long as is appropriate. Just at least be nice. Just kiss them at least while you're doing this. And so I think that we could actually have some better environmental benefits if enforcement were approached from beginning to end with a little bit more cooperative attitude in mind. Things might get settled faster, things might get worked out faster. And so I think that there is some advantage to doing that from time to time. Specifically on the article that Professors Flatt and Collins wrote, they really are to be commended for trying to delve into a very tricky, sticky issue that people have been trying to figure out, not for 20 years, indeed, but 40 years, since the agency began. There has always been the debate about how much enforcement, how is enforcement contributing to the improvement of the environment, and how do we measure the enforcement and its relation to environmental improvement. Professor Flatt mentioned in his article, this was the $64 billion question. How do we improve compliance with federal environmental laws and improve the quality of the environment? Well, the theme of my response here is up on the board there. It says, getting through the straits. It's not how much money you spend. It's charting the right course that counts. And that is the basic approach that I think will get us where we want to go, get us through the straits. Kim, you're going to have to push for me. Thanks. There's the question. We've mentioned that. If you could go to the next one, please. I would suggest that instead of any one answer or any one surrogate or any one measure of environmental effectiveness and environmental enforcement effectiveness, instead it is a lot of things that have to be considered to answer the question. It is not a simple answer. It involves monitoring, it involves enforcement, it involves compliance assistance. It involves the education of the regulated community. It involves cooperative enforcement, and certainly it involves funding for governmental agencies. And right now, especially our states are suffering in the environmental agencies as budget cuts have decimated many of their environmental departments. And certainly we look at EPA and look at the budget cuts that are going to be going on there. So funding is critical to get the job done. It's just that the way we count the funding and how we figure whether that gets the environmental enforcement results we need still needs, in my opinion, a lot of work. In the article, one of the key statements I thought was these two sentences. While recognizing that the individual nature of each state's enforcement actions meant that actual compliance achievement was not uniform, even for similarly situated sources, this challenges the assumption that enforcement automatically leads to compliance and focuses more on the type of enforcement that is occurring. And I think that, while it was not mentioned in the presentation, certainly is a statement from the article. And I think if you take that as a foundation statement, then you realize it's impossible to pick one thing out of the air and say this will give us the answer, or two things out of the air, and upon those one or two things make major policy recommendations, such as more funding needs to go to the states for enforcement in order to better protect the environment. Kim. They go on to, after, as Professor Flatt noted, there were a lot of difficulties in trying to get the data that he wanted, to get the results that he was trying to find the answers for, but they did have the three different kinds of data. One was the penalties assessed against people under the Clean Water Act. One was the penalties assessed against people under the Clean Air Act, and one was the number of quarters that facilities were in violation of compliance with the Clean Air Act regulatory requirements. And they compared that to the financial data that they were able to obtain. There's a lot of questions and uncertainties that I have about those data. starting with how accurate the budgetary data in fact are. In the article, it talks about some of the information was gotten from the state, some of it was gotten, online, it was gotten through phone calls. There were difficulties because the states don't keep their budgets in the same way. And in all fairness, there was an attempt to pull out the financial data that did not relate to the same type of environmental factors that we were looking at. But I know in these state budgets, it's almost impossible sometimes to disassociate spending on recreational things like fish, wildlife, and hunting from other environmental issues because the budgets can often be clumped together. Another question that I had was whether the state revolving loan funding was included as an element and used to say that financial spending in a state equals environmental enforcement, because state budgets are hugely made up and state spending is hugely made up, a disproportionate amount from state revolving loan funds. And so we don't know whether those state revolving loan fund monies went in to count as a surrogate for environmental enforcement, which obviously they should not be, and I certainly hope that they weren't in this particular case. Professor Flatt mentioned the data and the timing of it. These data are sometimes, in some cases, over a decade old at this point. And another thing that I thought was really not addressed here was in looking at the absolute dollars per capita that was being spent in each state for environmental protection, there was no accommodation for the differences in the cost of living in the different states, and therefore the spending and what would be purchased for a given dollar in a particular state. For example, if you spend $100 in the state of Tennessee, you probably buy far more in terms of environmental protection, more staffing, more monitoring. You probably buy a lot more there than you do spending $100 in California or New York, where the income of all of the environmental staff is going to be significantly above the income of the people who are someplace like Tennessee. So you have to look at those. And also, when you're assessing penalties, the penalties in these states, based upon their cost of comparative cost of living indices, would probably differ. States being wealthier, having higher income levels, having higher tax rates may indeed have higher penalties compared to other states. In spite of the somewhat recognized challenges that were faced with these data, the authors then go on to attempt to find one or two of these variables and say, upon these variables, we're going to make our environmental recommendations, which are really important recommendations. And I would suggest that we need better data before we make that leap to those recommendations. Kim? In terms of the results, what was found, which hasn't been mentioned in this presentation, was that for Clean Water Act, increased funding per capita, you had larger penalties. But for Clean Air Act, you had lower penalties. That data is inconclusive at best and contradictory at worst, and in my view should not be used for any type of analysis because you're getting two totally different answers. Similarly, the data in which you look at the period of time that you had a facility in violation of the Clean Air Act, it decreased by 0.2 quarters if there was an increase in $40 per capita spent. So 0.2 quarters, a quarter's 91 days, and 0.2 quarters for every dollar, if I did my little calculations right, which I'm not an economist, I would come up with that for every dollar spent, you get an increase in compliance. You get an increase of noncompliance of about half a day. If you look at those numbers, a $40 increase will give you 0.2% greater compliance per quarter. And so in my view, that if I did those calculations right, that's really not a significant correlation between environmental improvement and environmental compliance and the amount of money spent at the different state levels. It would not, in my case, in my view, be a strong relationship between the per capita spending on state environmental programs and shorter noncompliance rates. So what do you do? Let's just not get up here and throw stones. What do you do? I would suggest that EPA, in fact, probably when Eric was there, really did an excellent job starting in about 1996 of trying to move off of some of these lower level input data being how much is spent, what type of personnel you have, what type of resources you have, to start to try to focus on what the actual outcomes are. What is the effect that you're getting? And toward that end, EPA developed in 1996 a system that for every finished environmental action, the agency has to prepare a worksheet that lists how many pounds of pollutants are estimated to no longer be going into the environment for injunctive relief, for supplemental environmental projects, and other type of compliance activities. And they have there's a 2004 update on that report that sets out the measures that EPA looks at when they are trying to quantify the environmental benefits. In other words, outcomes that I think are much more important in terms of connecting enforcement dollars to actual environmental progress. Another reference that you could look at is the International Network for Environmental Compliance and Enforcement, an organization started in 1989 by EPA, and they have a logic system that has four different categories of indicators: input indicators, the ones that we're talking about here, how much are you putting into the system, output indicators, which is the activity, that's the number of enforcement actions taken, the amount of dollars collected, and then you move to higher levels of indicators, which are considered more valid, intermediate outcome indicators, which is, are you changing environmental performance? Are you changing environmental compliance somewhat? And then the final outcome indicators, which would be, are you getting any environmental improvements? Are we seeing actual improvement in ambient water quality and things of that sort? Real quickly, a couple more points. I love the part about that the data showed that the conservative politically elite states had better compliance than the liberal political elite states, because I am a very green Republican. And so I kind of like that part of it. It was not emphasized a lot during any of these conversations, but I think it's one that goes very well with the thought that there are a lot of folks out there who do believe in that rule of law, and that conservatives certainly are among those. So let me just kind of real briefly mention that enforcement, it's really about seeking behavioral modification. And I think one huge thing that we need to realize that is different than it was 40 years ago is that maybe 40 years ago when EPA was started, most of the compliance and most of the behavioral modification would follow a theory called the logic of the consequences. You're going to do something because if you don't, you're going to get in trouble. EPA maintained that it was the gorilla in the closet and would come out and enforce against people who didn't do the right thing. So it was that fear factor there. I would suggest that over the last 40 years, that we as a nation, as people, as corporations, as municipalities, have begun to move away from a strict logic of consequences to more of a logic of appropriateness. And that is that I think more and more people today, whether they're working in a corporation or working for the agencies, want to be in compliance and want to do the right thing. And therefore, I think a time has come for us to shift in some of our actions and begin to provide them as much, if not more, assistance in accomplishing their goal. You think about like Dan Estes' book, Green to Gold. Corporations throughout the world are realizing that it's good to be green. And so I think that is a major shift that the agency has really not accommodated in a number of years by recognizing that more and more people are trying to do the right thing. So just to conclude, I would say that if you are a sailor and you're trying to, we can just go to the next slide, Kim. If you're a sailor and you're trying to get through narrow straits, you cannot pick one factor out of a bunch of them and make it safely through. For example, you have to calculate the tide. You have to calculate the current. You have to think about the wind. You have to think about how wide the strait is. You have to think about how much the boat's going to draw. You have to think about a whole myriad of factors in order to get through that safely. You cannot pick out one and say that is what is going to get us through the straits. I would say, similarly, in the terms of environmental protection and enforcement and its relation to improving environmental quality, we cannot pick out any one thing and safely navigate through the answers and come up with the answers to those questions any more than we can take a sailboat through a narrow strait at sea. Thank you.
Thank you, Luana. Would you like to take a few minutes, Professor Flatt?
Yeah.
Okay.
To clarify this, because I think that's very important, and then I'll get more generally. You had concerns about the budget data, and of course that was one of our biggest concerns from the very beginning, which is why we spent an inordinate amount of time backing out, talking to people, trying to get like-to-like as best we could. But that's how we ended up with a recommendation that the budget data be reported in a uniform manner, precisely because, you know, you're making assumptions. There's no doubt. And I think we were very careful with it. But there's certainly a possibility of error on that. But I think we were, you know, we talked about, we asked, like, for instance, before we back out a wildlife fund, we asked exactly what that covered and, you know, that sort of thing. And in the appendix, you see exactly which states were adjusted based on that. But that's a very important question. The dollars per capita spending accommodation for the cost of living, we looked at that actually very closely and almost put that in. At the state level, with the exception of Hawaii, the cost of living is not widely out of range between the states. But the problem we realized is that when you started to do that, you had to look at where the employees lived. So it wasn't California versus Tennessee. It was Sacramento and San Francisco versus Nashville, or Albany and New York, or Austin and Houston. I mean, because you have to see where the data goes. And then, again, one of the things we were hoping that could be solved somehow by how some of that data is reported, but that's a very good point. The point about the increased funding and the larger penalties in the Clean Air Act and lower penalties, we think the difference with that came because we had the quarters of noncompliance data in the Clean Air Act to hold, whereas we didn't have it in the Clean Water Act. And since it showed up to be a statistically significant factor there, we think that may be why they came out differently, and again, we couldn't get the Clean Water Act data. But we didn't want to hide anything, so, right, we put it out there. And the question about the significance, when we talk about it being a significant association between money spent and reduction in quarters of noncompliance, it's significant from a statistical standpoint. That doesn't mean it's significant from a policymaking standpoint. That could be a very different question. How much money are you willing to spend to do that? And I think that's a very important question to bring up. And I think the last comment I want to make, again, going backwards about your comments, is that one of the first points you made is absolutely, I think, correct, which is that we do know that this is more than one factor. And we look at the states as laboratories of experiments of how they balance personnel and assistance and penalties and when they bring, you know, compliance violations and when they go to court and when they don't. It's a mix of many, many things. And that's why we measured all of sort of the environmental program, but we would have liked to have seen it split between air, you know, water, river. So the idea is that if you look at the per capita spending on all of that, it's not just money on how many people you take to court. And if you actually could look at 17 different states and come up with a marker of how they balance that enforcement, is it more cooperative? And, you know, I know that's, again, also just one thing, but is it more this versus more that? Then you might actually be able to get that data, that you look at the laboratories to see which ones actually work better. Because as we can tell from this discussion, we still don't agree if that is true or not. And just, again, some other brief comments. The article isn't clear about defining enforcement, and there's an enforcement from the AG's office perspective, which is actually going to court and where you're maybe the enemy, but there's the broader enforcement, which is we want these laws to be followed, which could have all kinds of things, more regulatory assistance, rather things besides that, and we're trying to measure that, and I think sometimes that wasn't, you know, as clear as it could have been. I think Eric's point about looking at a narrow focus may be, in fact, the right one. I mean, we hoped to try to get at this very big question, but without the data as we would hope to see it structured. At this point, that may not be possible. And I think your focus, I think the results we've seen from continuous emission monitoring is incredibly important. And I think you also make the point, which we talk about briefly in the paper, that this assumes that all the permits are issued correctly in the first place and all the things are permitted correctly. But if you look at some of the state of Texas's permits on these plant area-wide limits, they're like out of whack because they're based on modeling and estimates that are 20 or 25 years old. So there's so many assumptions that you have to get to that point. And I very much agree with that. And I think maybe for the future, we could try to focus on some narrower things like, does continuous emission monitoring, does that improve compliance or not? So I guess there may be more comments here, and I'll just end by asking your opinion on two things. One, is it fair to look at non-compliant times as some kind of a marker for how good the package of enforcement is, like assistance, prosecution, penalties, all of that? And does it make sense to try to ask states to report data in a way that allows us to compare those things? I guess that's the, so that's all.
I'll just address the latter, having most recently come from managing state environmental agencies. And I'll just have to say that right now, I'm glad I'm not there, primarily because their budgets have been cut so, so much to deal with the economic crisis that this nation is facing. And I think if right now you ask states to do any more, they are being kept together by bubble gum. And I just think now is not a good time to ask them to do anything else, because eventually they get so frustrated that they think we have no way that we're ever going to do everything that needs to be done, so why even try?
I mean, I would say, and the answer to both, and I actually completely agree with Luana, who was a state manager, our whole nature of environmental laws is based on this notion of cooperative federalism, where we really do give states much independent authority in that regard, and then hope it works. And so coming up with commonality is not easy on virtually any issue that you can think of in that regard. It would be nice. By the way, it would be nice if we had common data inside the federal government. It would be nice to have common data inside of an individual agency. Pick anyone you want. And it's probably not true. And by the way, those of you who are in companies know that your company probably does not have common data elements. Your first question was harder, and that is, quarters of non-compliance a indicator? Yes, in some ways, but then we go back, I think, to some of the things that Eric was talking about, and that is, not all enforcement and not all compliance is the same.
Right.
Whether or not you are in compliance with a Clean Water Act discharge limit because you're reporting DMRs is frankly a lot different than if you're in compliance with an NSR or a PSD a regulation.
Right, that's right.
And I could not agree with Eric more that monitoring is in fact incredibly important in that regard, and we do not have uniform monitoring. By the way, while I'm agreeing with people, Luana will actually be shocked to have me say that I actually completely agree with her, that we are better, way better, in compliance, both companies and individuals, than we have been in the past. That's absolutely, I think, true. Having said that, I actually think that makes enforcement more important. Here's why. And that is, if in fact you're a company and you're spending $200 million to put a scrubber on your plant and your competitor does not, your competitor gets a $200 million advantage, economic advantage, right then. So the company that's doing the right thing suffers if in fact their competitors are not complying with the law. And so as we in fact have more people comply, I think that means enforcement is more important, and it's more important from an economic level playing field aspect than just almost any other factor. So I agree, but I think that means enforcement is more important.
I just want to mention there's an actual case right now that I can't say the names of, but there are two almost identical plants, one on the Louisiana side, one on the Texas side. On the Texas side, they have not been required to get the permit, and they have on the Louisiana side, and it's exactly that $200 million question. And it goes back to these prior things.
I'm biting my lip. I think looking at length of time out of compliance, where you have like sources and reliable monitoring data, makes good sense. And you have to have common definitions such that returning to compliance doesn't mean there's a consent decree.
Right, it can't be
a
consent decree.
So you have to sort of control.
And actually, the data does show when it's stopped by a consent decree versus when it's back in compliance.
Which is helpful. And as long as you kind of deal with the nuances and are dealing with, again, a section of the industry where you can do comparable analysis, I think that would be good, very useful, in fact. And we try to look at that kind of thing in our work. I think on the sort of larger issue of have we evolved into becoming just sort of better people, generally, are we better people than we were 40 years ago? I think the conservative position is not really. Human nature doesn't really change that quickly. Corporations, if anything, are under more pressure to cash in the next quarter. If you've got a hedge fund behind a company and they don't really want to spend a lot of money, you've got a new set of problems. So where the monitoring is good, and I hate to harp on this, but where the monitoring is good and the pattern's been laid down, and either through enforcement or through the regulatory push, the company's already spent the money on the scrubber, we're better, okay? We're better. Where you have shades of gray and holes that are left in the permit or arise because the monitoring is worthless, and basically it's a dog-eat-dog fight to establish liability, we are exactly where we were 40 years ago, 100 years ago, and we'll be in the same place 100 years from now.
On that upbeat note, do we have any questions? I knew I could count on you.
Just to throw a little.
I have a little quick off one idea. The thought is just that it's almost tax day, and one of the best predictors of tax payment is that you have your income reported independently to the federal government or the state government. So if you, and there's a deep tax literature, which I think is actually quite relevant to the environmental literature. Many of the same phenomena exist for taxes. Some don't.
I've just got a very quick one. I can't resist. It was Malcolm Sparrow, and maybe you heard
right,
of
sure,
this example. I don't know when it was that the IRS required, instead of just saying how many dependents you had, you had to write down the children's names and their social security number as you do today. And we had an incredible collapse in the birth rate.
Right.
Children disappeared, and apparently a lot of people said, oh, you meant my children. and taxes went up. Now imagine trying to, quote, enforce that by culling through statements about how many dependents people had and then figuring out how to target and so on, compared with a simple act of write their names down and their social security number. That's maybe the best example of monitoring that I can give.
So Eric's response is a great example of my second idea, which ties in with Wendy's idea from before that was getting lambasted by everyone here except me. I was sitting there pulling for it. So this notion of sort of platonic visionaries who come up with ideas, I think maybe the reason you got some of the reactions you did is that it was embedded within the regulatory process. But I think it's valuable within agencies to take people who are really good thinkers and pull them together and say, how could we redesign the system? We don't do that very often. And one time when I think it was successfully done was an effort that Eric led within EPA that maybe some others in the room participated in, which I thought was quite successful. Not all of it worked, but when the enforcement reorg was underway at EPA, there was a separate group sitting there saying, now how might we redesign this? Again, was it all successful? Did every idea pan out? I don't think it did. But I think some of the ideas that were the most successful came out of that group, looking at industrial sectors, trying to think of different ways to report environmental performance. So maybe, Wendy, one way to take that idea and run with it in a way that doesn't raise some of the hackles that you heard is not to embed it so deeply in the regulatory development process per se, but to look for that as something that agencies do periodically in certain areas. And I think maybe enforcement is an area where we could use that again. We might want to get some of the best thinkers together to say, all right, now that we know what we do know over the last 40 years, how might we better design environmental enforcement moving forward?
Mm-hmm. We have a question here.
Yeah, I wonder to what extent, from the economy's point of view, it doesn't matter whether the money is spent by the state or by the private sector. So I'm wondering to what extent you tried to get a handle on the coming into compliance costs expenditures by the regulated entities?
We didn't. Go ahead. Well, we actually didn't look at that at all. The assumption is that if you're in a similar industry area, you face the same compliance cost. And since we compare the kind of violation with the most, if you had multiple violations, it was the one that EPA listed as the primary violation. So if you could do about pollutant versus the Clean Air Act,
and it would be across the same industrial sector. So if you had a ozone or particulate violation here and a particulate violation there, again, the assumption was they faced the same cost curve in coming into compliance and that would be captured by the compliance rate. So in other words, yeah, I mean, that could be...
free compliance assistance from the state, or I have to shop it out to a compliance consultant.
Now, that's a good point. And presumably, though, if you get compliance from the state, that's captured in the state's expenditure. And they're spending more. And so that, you know, if our thing is correct, they're spending more, it's cooperative, but they help you come into compliance, you come into compliance sooner because you don't face the same cost curve that your competitor does.
Well, I think we need to wrap up. This has been an excellent panel, and before we thank you, all the panels are great today, and I just want to remind everyone that there was another article selected this year, and Professor Heather Hughes is actually here in the audience, and we had a lively discussion about her article on investing in sustainability in Nashville last month. So I encourage everyone to look at the website, the ELI website, and the Vanderbilt website if you want to find a link to the full articles. And then this summer, as a special issue of ELR, we will publish short forms of the articles along with all the comments that you heard today. So thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for a terrific panel.
Thank you.